And we should be fine.
All right, it's recording.
Okay, everyone, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you all for coming. We have a few quick announcements before I want to turn it over to Jason, who's our speaker for the day. The first is that ACS, FedSoc, Outlaw, and the Law Women's Caucus will be sponsoring an event with Judge Posner on January 26th at 4 p.m. here. Also, ACS is going to be having its 1L elections at the end of January, so please stay tuned for more details about that. If you have any questions, feel free to approach me or any other ACS board members. Thanks.
First of all, I'd like to thank Hoffman for coming from DC today to speak to us, and also thank Outlaw for generously co-sponsoring this event. Paul Smith chairs Jenner & Block's appellate litigation practice in DC. He is a graduate of Yale Law School after attending Yale. He clerked for Judge Oates in the Second Circuit, and then Chief Justice Powell, he's litigated 13 times in the Supreme Court, including some cases you're probably familiar with, Celotex, LUAC, Bite. Most recently, he litigated the Texas sodomy case, Lawrence. And today he's here to speak to us on litigating gay marriage. He recently submitted an amicus brief to the Connecticut Supreme Court on behalf of the American Psychological Association that everybody says was really persuasive in the outcome of that case. So it's our pleasure to have him today. Chair of the board of the American Constitution Society.
Yes.
That's
I was going to mention that, actually. As of, I guess, 12 days ago, I'm no longer chair of the board of ACS, but it was a fun 3 years to do that. And so before I get started, let me give my little ACS speech. It's always one of the great things to do when you're on the ACS board to come talk to an ACS chapter. And this is certainly one of the great strong chapters in the country, the Chicago chapter, because they're just wonderful people, and it's always a great exchange of views, and I hope we'll have that today. It's a really exciting time in Washington for ACS, because, as you may know, things have slightly changed. Change there in terms of the kind of attention we're getting from the world, and in terms of access, we've so far had our executive director given a very senior position in the White House, and three board members given positions of prominence, including Mr. Holder, who will be the Attorney General, and Ron Klain, who's the Chief of Staff to Mr. Biden, and Don Johnson, who took on the extremely important job of Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, where they write those memos about torture that have to be revised and that sort of thing. So ACS is really integrated in many different ways with the Obama administration, and we're looking forward to maintaining our role as a source of ideas and policy proposals and a place for dialogue in the future as the Obama administration goes forward. Topic today, I guess, is litigating gay marriage. And let me say, I don't have a major policy address to deliver. You'll all be pleased to hear. I just have some thoughts about where we are and where we're going in that area. And let me just say, having announced that I would speak on that topic, it's actually not the case that I've really done much in the way of litigating gay marriage. I'm here, as Jason suggested, for maybe three different reasons. One, I was in the right place at the right time and got to argue the Lawrence versus Texas case along with Lambda Legal. And that was, in many ways, I think, an indirect part of the impetus, what led to this last 5 years of active litigation on same-sex marriage around the country. That, in turn, led me to be on the board of directors of Lambda Legal, which is certainly one of the two or three most important organizations litigating these issues on the front line. So I get to hear from our litigators a lot of the times in board meetings. And as Jason said, we also regularly do amicus briefs for the American Psychological Association at Jenner, where we essentially write what they call the Gay is Good brief, which is a theme being gay people are not crazy, they are good parents, their children do fine, you should not be drawing distinctions in this area, and if you go ahead and have marriage, the world will not end. And so those are the sort of roles I play in the area of gay marriage. So I thought I'd just talk about a few things. One, why is it that the gay rights movement in the last 10 years has swerved rather dramatically toward this enormous focus on same-sex marriage rights? you may not all perceive it as a swerve, but if you went back 10 years ago, I think it would have been surprising, I think, to people who are actively litigating in this area, the amount of attention that marriage has gotten. In those days, the focus was on, first of all, still on sodomy, which was the huge problem that eventually was finally eliminated in the Lawrence case, but also on other forms of specific discrimination, job discrimination, people losing their jobs, people losing their children, people being denied access to the military, all of those kinds of issues. And then sort of the marriage issue kind of snuck up on the movement, as there was a case brought in Hawaii by people who were not really insiders, and it kind of then was kind of grasped onto by people like Evan Wolfson, who's one of the big litigators in this area. And then the Vermont Civil Unions case came along, and it started starting to snowball. And it was controversial in many ways for a while, and remains still controversial in some quarters. There are still people out there. Nancy Polakoff is a law professor at AU, American University in Washington, who's written a book saying we shouldn't be fighting for gay marriage rights. But largely it's become, I think, the sort of consensus position that this makes sense as the primary litigation focus, even as groups like Lambda Legal continue to work on, you know, rights of students, rights of employees, rights of children, lots of other issues simultaneously, HIV and those sorts of things. And I think the reason is that it gradually everyone figured out that if you talk about equality for gay people, what you're really ultimately talking about is equality for our relationships. And equal recognition and dignity for those relationships, because that's really what it's all about. And in what the single estate in our society that defines the relationship that we most honor and most cherish and give most importance to is marriage. And so it makes ultimately quite good sense to say that same-sex couples ought to have the exact same recognition and dignity and opportunity for recognition as other married couples. And in some ways, I think the sense is that while you can continue to fight other kinds of discrimination one case at a time or one issue at a time, and hopefully lots of progress will continue to be made in that in those other fronts, if you can win on marriage, then the whole kind of structure of justifying discrimination against gay people falls away, because once you have you're in a state or a place where people are given equal marriage rights, there really isn't any sense in which it makes any sense to continue denying people job rights or other kinds of rights. That becomes such an important sort of recognition. So in some ways, it's kind of the opposite of the regime that existed under the old, before Lawrence era, when Bowers versus Hardwick was the law. And what they used to say then was, this was a favorite of Justice Scalia, to say, look, if it's perfectly constitutional to criminalize being gay, then almost any kind of discrimination is justifiable. And now, I mean, it's sort of the obverse. Now, if in places where marriage rights have been won, it's really difficult to justify any form of discrimination or disparate treatment of gay people, because you have that such core recognition. So that is really how it has evolved. And I think that's clearly one reason why on the marriage issue is where we've run into this very strong opposition movement, because they perceive that it's kind of all the marbles are at stake if marriage rights are ultimately won, that there will not be any, you know, distinction then thereafter between heterosexuals and homosexuals in terms of their basic status in society and their rights. That's quite different from the reaction that Lawrence itself got. I, having argued that case, received zero hostile mail or emails or phone calls from anyone in the whole country. There was simply no negative reaction to lifting sodomy laws and letting people alone just 5 years ago. In fact, I've heard stories about how on Rush Limbaugh's show he was going on and on that day about how terrible the Supreme Court was for mandating gay rights, and all of the conservative listeners of his show were calling in saying, "This is ridiculous, Rush. Even we think you should be able to, you should have the police stay out of your bedroom," you know. And so that was a non-controversial decision, but it led directly to Goodrich almost within a few months, the Massachusetts gay marriage case, and this sort of movement toward recognition of same-sex relationships, just as Justice Scalia in his dissent said it would. And it is at the point of legal recognition that there's this very strong, virulent opposition that has developed. The other sort of reason I think the opposition focuses on marriage is there's this constant kind of complicated relationship between the legal institution of marriage, the civil institution of marriage, and the religious institution of marriage. And people don't appear to have some great difficulty distinguishing between the two and feeling as if somehow by forcing civil marriage to be equal for everybody, that's somehow interfering with religious liberty or religious rights, or in some ways not giving full respect to people's religious beliefs about who they think and their religion ought to be married. And I think a lot of that has actually deliberately been created. If you look at the campaign in California this year, there was an enormous amount of stuff going on in these commercials that were put on suggesting that churches were going to be forced to marry people that they didn't want to marry and that sort of thing. But those are the two elements of it, I think, that have led to this to be the really the firestorm place where the fight has gone on in the last 5 years. And at this point, of course, we are actually now at a point where much of the fighting is going on in states where gay couples can get civil union, or whatever you call it, domestic partnerships. And indeed, in states where the state law at least says you get this other status, but you have all the rights of married people. And so one of the questions you might ask is, why is everybody fighting so hard to, in those states, change the designation from civil union to marriage? California being a perfect example, Connecticut another one. The Supreme Court of Connecticut just said civil union law is not good enough, we have to have marriage. And in California, they had a thoroughgoing domestic partner law with all of the same state law rights as marriage, but the fight still went on up to the Supreme Court of California, won marriage rights, and then, of course, had the huge campaign for Prop 8 to have it taken back. And I think there's sort of two reasons why people keep fighting in those situations. One is the old separate but equal remains true. There really isn't. It isn't true that you can simply legislate two different statuses, call it two different things, and say they're the same, and have it really be the same. There was a very interesting report that was released a few weeks ago by a commission in New Jersey. New Jersey being another state that has civil unions mandated to be identical to marriage rights, at least as a matter of state law. And they did a study about what is it really like to be in a civil union in New Jersey, and how do you get treated, and what are its effects. And there's a whole variety of ways in which it's unequal. When kids go to school, they don't get treated as if they have married parents. Very, very often, employers deny health insurance to same-sex civil union couples. And indeed, the state can't do anything about that, because if it's a self-funded insurer, employer health plan, it's regulated only by ERISA. And ERISA, being a federal statute, is affected by the Defense of Marriage Act, so that the ERISA does not mandate equal treatment of people who are civil union in New Jersey. And so it's up to the employers to decide if they want to treat a couple with a civil union in New Jersey whether they're the same as married couples, and very, very often they don't. So there's an awful lot of people who actually haven't gotten insurance benefits with their partner after entering into a civil union. And then there's a lot of horrible stories in this report about what happens when somebody has a medical emergency and goes to the hospital, and their civil union spouse shows up and tries to talk to the doctor and ends up having a 25-minute legal discussion with them about what it means to be in a civil union and how the state law mandates that they be treated like a spouse. So there really is a very strong sort of evidentiary case to be made that separate but equal doesn't work. And then there's this sort of other aspect of it, which is to say, why is it that anybody wants to use two different words if it's supposed to be the same thing? What purpose is there to maintain two different sets of terminology other than to stigmatize one group and make it not be given the same full status in our society as the other? So for those two reasons, that's why people keep fighting for use of the M word as the most important aspect of ultimately moving toward a greater recognition, a greater equality for gay relationships. Now, so where does the fight stand at this point? Well, it's a mixed story, obviously. Massachusetts and Connecticut appear to be completely locked in. There seems to be no movement to do anything about eliminating marriage rights in those two states. And I think you're going to continue to see other places in New England and that general area, Rhode Island, perhaps New Hampshire, moving in the direction of recognizing marriage rights as well. There's a lot of talk in Vermont about going from civil unions to marriage. And in other parts of the Northeast, there's a lot of optimism. For the reasons I was talking about in terms of this report, there's a great deal of sense that within a year, New Jersey may well pass marriage rights, full marriage rights, legislatively in indeed there's a strong majority support in the polling and in the legislature for that at this point in New Jersey. So I think that's what you're going to see. And while there's a bit of a political mess in the New York State Senate, the Democrats having just taken that over but still having trouble working out the leadership fight there, ultimately there's a good deal of hope that in New York it will be passed legislatively as well. You also see in New York already a full recognition of people who are married in other states. So a great many people in New York are already treated as married, even though they're in same-sex couples who are married in Canada or Massachusetts or elsewhere. So clearly that whole region of the country is moving very strongly in the direction of same-sex marriage. There's also this case that was recently argued in the Iowa Supreme Court by Lambda Legal. They tell me that Iowa is a place where everybody thinks this, we can make a real beachhead in the middle of the country, that the Iowa Supreme Court is probably going to be helpful and is going to go ahead and recognize equal marriage rights. That we won in the trial court in a very strong opinion. So that's the sort of Midwestern next great option. And then there's California, which is, who knows where that's all going to end up. We have now pending in the California Supreme Court a whole variety of briefing on the question of whether or not Proposition 8 was or was not lawful under state law. The California Constitution having this bizarre situation where there's two different ways to change it, amendments versus revisions. And while I'm not an expert on the California Constitution, from what I can tell, the main difference between the two depends on whether the change is considered sufficiently fundamental that it has to go through the legislature first and be treated as a revision. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with how broad it is or how many different provisions you're changing or whether or anything, just sort of some sense of qualitative fundamentalist. And there are cases on both sides that would support the notion that Prop 8 was proper or improper, and no one is really sure where that is all going. Obviously, politically, it is a difficult situation for the California Supreme Court, having allowed the vote to go ahead, to then say that it was improper and it should have gone through the legislature first before it went to the people, instead of just being put on the ballot by a fair number of petitions. But they may well agree with us. The Attorney General of California, Jerry Brown, has come out and said Prop 8 is illegal, improper under the state constitution. So there's some sense that that may yet happen and may get rid of Prop 8, and then you'd have full marriage rights again in California. There's almost, there seems to be very little sense that there's any likelihood the California Supreme Court is going to try to unmarry the tens of thousands of people who were married during 2008. If they did, it would set up a very interesting federal constitutional case about whether a state can en masse by law simply unmarry people. I think that would be a good case. That would be a case I would take to the Supreme Court. Now, whatever happens in the California Supreme Court, I think it's fairly clear that within a few years, California will take Prop 8 back by another popular referendum. And it's interesting to look at what the demographics of that vote were. It was 52-48. And if you look at age cohorts, the only age group in the entire electorate that voted for Prop 8 was people 65 and over. Everybody below it, every 10-year tranche, it was approximately 52-48 against it. So there is clearly a sort of demographic destiny going on here that gay marriage is becoming the popular position among younger people. And just sort of parenthetically, we had a lot of conversation right after Prop 8 passed about the impact of racial politics and whether black people, for example, played an enormously oversized role in passing Proposition 8. There's been a more recent, more careful polling on that question in a report that was published by the National Lesbian Gay Task Force just the other day. And it said, first of all, that these early exit polls vastly overstated the percentage of blacks who voted for it in California. The exit polls had said it was close to 70-30. Turns out it was more like 59-41 among African Americans and about the same among Hispanics. But if you take into account church going as a factor in the sort of statistical analysis, and you equalize white people with those two other groups in terms of church going, then it turns out that church going is really the explanatory factor, that African Americans and Hispanics just tend to go to church a lot more than white people. And so it is the factors that really explain the outcome are age, religiosity, and those sorts of things. And, you know, so as the culture continues to get more used to this, I think California certainly was an example of a state where the vote will go the other way fairly soon. And it's just as if it turns out we lose in the California Supreme Court, it'll be just as easy to get it on the ballot again to amend it back the other way once people feel like the political ducks are in a row and the money's ready to be spent on it this time. Ultimately, I just don't see how in a place like that, the other side can hold the line that much longer. I mean, part of the reason why I think ultimately the sort of the gay rights, the gay marriage people will ultimately win, at least in many states, is if you ever actually look at the briefs that are being filed and the arguments that are being made by the other side about why it is that that it would be harmful to have gay marriage, what are the concrete harms that are being prevented by preventing same-sex couples from being married? They're very, very convoluted. It's very difficult for them to find anything harmful that happens. They use slogans like, this will undermine the institution of marriage, or this will hurt children, or something like that. But then you get a little bit more concrete about it. Exactly what does that mean? And in what way is the institution of marriage affected by allowing a fairly small percentage of the population to join in it? Or in what way are children harmed? And when you take into account the fact that there are already hundreds of thousands of families in this country which have two same-sex heads of households with children in the house, it's a little bit hard to understand the sort of children arguments as well. So they really don't have a good argument on the merits. And as people your age come along and become controlling the voting in this country, I mean, I just don't see how the outcome is really ultimately in doubt politically. Now, there are people who would say that this fight that's been waged for the past 5 or 10 years has been somewhat counterproductive because it produced a fairly severe backlash. And we have, 35 amendments passed around the country in various states banning gay marriage. And so certainly you can make a case that there's a backlash. This is something that people sort of talk about whenever you talk about a big constitutional argument being resolved, at least initially, by the courts. They talked about it at Brown versus Board of Education, Roe v. Wade, the death penalty, various areas in which there's a theory that somehow or other winning a constitutional right is sometimes worse than losing it because the backlash comes along. But certainly it's my view that in this area, at least, whatever's happened in those 35 states that were not likely to pass gay marriage anyway with these amendments, it has been enormously effective to have gone to these state Supreme Courts and won these rights. And I say that in part because the attitudes of this country have changed so dramatically as a result of the fact that people are getting married in Massachusetts and that people are seeing the sky is not falling, and they see these sort of cute couples that have been together for 40 years finally getting some public recognition. When Vermont started fighting over civil unions a decade ago, this was the radical position, and it almost cost Howard Dean the governorship, and it was a big, huge deal. Now civil unions has become kind of the conservative position, where people who want to maintain some distinction talk about civil unions. And marriage rights have come now to the point where they're supported by something approaching half the population, if not quite there yet. Certainly the direction is heading that way. And it's largely because of litigation. You could never even imagine the kind of support that gay marriage has in this country if you hadn't had litigators out there winning these constitutional cases. The fight obviously will go on, but this is a case where the culture and the political culture and the culture were very much jump-started by litigation and by judges reaching decisions and then people actually being able to exercise their rights and people seeing this. And suddenly what seemed like a really crazy idea becomes kind of not a big deal. And I think that will continue to be the place, to be the way this continues to go. And, so where does this all take us? What if you were looking down the road 10 or 15 or 20 years, where will we be on gay marriage? My personal view is that sooner or later, the Supreme Court will say there's a right to same-sex marriage, just as it eventually did to say that you can't deny people the right to interracial marriage. About 20 years after the first state Supreme Court in California said that you, under the state constitution, you can't discriminate on the basis of race in denying people right to marry. In Loving versus Virginia, was ultimately what the Supreme Court of the United States held that. It may take some time, but ultimately, Justice Scalia said in his dissent in Lawrence that the arguments are all laid out there in the majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy for gay marriage. And, you know, it really isn't that hard to sit down with the Lawrence opinion and figure out how you'd write the brief if you wanted to argue for a federal constitutional right to marry. It has been certainly the view by the litigators in this area, on my side, that we should not be doing that yet, that this is too soon, and that this, the country's not ready, the court's not ready. There is, I think, some danger that others will now take the case up through the federal courts probably sooner than we'd like, because there's an awful lot of people in California who are upset, probably tens of thousands of them that are upset. And they can hire lawyers, and lawyers decide they want to be the big heroes. And so this may well happen. And the result is you might end up with kind of a Bowers versus Hardwick situation where it gets to the court a little too soon, and 5-4 or 6-3 or something, you could lose. That could happen. But in the long run, because of the changing political culture and because of the arguments, as I said, on the other side are so weak, I just ultimately see the court eventually recognizing that you have a fundamental interest in choosing who you want to marry, and there's no reason why that fundamental interest ought to be denied to people on the basis of the gender who they happen to select as their mate. And so that's sort of where I see it going. I suppose others may think otherwise, but that's sort of, we're sort of in the middle, I think, of this process that will go on with some major ups and downs over the next few years, but eventually that seems to be where the sort of arc of history is heading. So those are my thoughts on the subject. I think it would be better if we have a conversation on this anyway. So why don't you, if you could, guys, ask me some questions. Sure.
I was wondering, you said at the beginning of your talk that under ERISA, companies only have to recognize marriage. And I was just wondering, does that mean that they only have to recognize federal marriage or state marriage?
It means that they can make their choice, that states are not allowed to regulate that particular aspect of the way self-funded employers. See, there's two ways you can have a pension plan if you're an employer. Either you can pay for it yourself out of your own pocket, or you can buy an insurance policy. Insurance policies are regulated by states, because insurance in this country is a state-regulated industry. But self-funded rights of that kind are regulated only by federal law, and the ERISA preempts all state regulation. So for self-funded employers, which is about half of the health insurance in New Jersey, the state can't get at it. Only federal law can make them recognize same-sex marriages. And because of the Defense of Marriage Act, no federal law recognizes any same-sex couples for anything. So until we can get the federal law fixed, there's always going to be those employers who are able to ignore state laws and whether the state is calling it civil unions or marriage, frankly, they can just basically just choose not to recognize those marriages if they want to. They're much less likely to do it, I think, in states where they use the M word than in states where they use a civil union term, because once you start calling people married, the momentum toward treating everybody the same just gets much stronger, and employers would have a much more difficult time, I think, starting to discriminate in that way. But at least that's the hope in places like New Jersey, where they're talking about going from using the term civil union to using the term marriage. Yeah.
So far you've been looking at in terms of strategy. I'm wondering if you get down to some tactics. Specifically, I'm wondering, I know some courts have talked about, have found suspect class or something nearing suspect class for gays and lesbians, and sort of the scrutiny change that comes along with that. Uh-huh. So I think Connecticut went toward heightened scrutiny, and maybe California and Massachusetts didn't.
Yeah, two federal courts of appeals have recently held that intermediate scrutiny applies under the federal constitution in don't ask, don't tell cases. So that seems to be heading in the direction of recognizing heightened scrutiny, though maybe not strict scrutiny, sort of like the level for gender discrimination, which makes a certain amount of sense considering it is a kind of gender discrimination anyway.
I mean, do you think that's a good idea for plaintiffs to be pursuing that argument, or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, certainly in state courts, you should be making those arguments, and they do consistently make those arguments. But there's always the fallback position, which is you don't need to have heightened scrutiny because under the kind of Romer paradigm or O'Connor concurrence in Lawrence, you can even win under rational basis with bite scrutiny, where there's a sense that there's animus involved and there's no real reason to discriminate anyway. But I think they certainly should be heightened, arguing for some level of heightened scrutiny in any kind of gay discrimination case at this point involving state action. And that seems to be where they're going. The courts finally, in the federal cases, started to recognize that Lawrence can't be understood as a leaving rational basis scrutiny in place. But Lawrence has been it's a wonderfully poetic and case I should never say a negative thing about. It is a little hard to figure out exactly what the analytical structure that is when you read it. But you know, it's certainly always been my view from the very beginning that Lawrence says it's the same as the right to choose or right to access to birth control. It's a fundamental right, and any denial of it has to be justified by at least a substantial or compelling interest, not just a rational basis. And I think that's where the courts are finally going. Yeah.
One of the sources of opposition in St. Lawrence versus Texas was the new file by Robert Jordan and Jerry Bradley on that focus on the fantasy. We're talking about only about 20 years, maybe the Supreme Court will find a constitutional right for same-sex marriage. But how would you anticipate that source of opposition evolving over the next 20 years?
So, remind me what that brief said, if you could, because truth is, the amicus briefs on the other side of Lawrence's case were really wacky, most of them.
Yeah, but the George and Bradley brief was probably the most extreme brief that was intellectually consistent. It was Andrew Sullivan wrote an article about it that essentially the George and Bradley brief discusses how homosexuals shouldn't really have any rights. When it's perfectly fine to discriminate against them for anything, and they're not able to raise children effectively. I mean, it went through the natural law type arguments.
And it
seems like that's it's small, but it's will be a persistent source of opposition towards.
Right, but there's always going to be people that disagree with any movement toward equality, and that doesn't mean you don't move toward equality. And there's still people who are bigoted against black people in this country, but we still have the laws and the rights. And you know, I'm not suggesting that those are all exactly comparable, but because there are legitimate religious beliefs involved in the case of anti-gay stuff to some extent, but. You know, I think if you went in the evangelical community, people under 30 think the idea that you would discriminate against people just because they're gay doesn't make any sense anymore. It's starting to change even there. And if you imagine a world in which hopefully in the next 4 years you'll have employment discrimination protections, hate crimes protections, people serving openly in the military, and three or four more states with people getting married, I mean, that's going to become, I think, the broad majority position in just the way that people began learned about civil rights in the 50s and 60s, and how people learned about equality for women in the 70s and 80s, just by virtue of the way the law was moving and the culture was moving, and it sort of becomes a snowballing effect. At least that's my hope, and I think my expectation too. Yes, sir.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about religious people being upset or afraid that they're somehow going to be forced to marry people that they don't want to or whatever. I agree with you that that's probably not going to be a problem, but there has been some discussion about adoptions, where religious institutions are giving adoptions to people maybe within their own religious institution or people with similar values or something like that. I was wondering if you could comment on that, what do you think happen there?
I'm not really familiar with this problem with religion and adoption. These are like adoption agencies by the Catholic Church or something like that.
There's kind of a big to-do about the Catholic Church not wanting to give adoptions to same-sex people or married.
But they probably give adoptions to Jewish and Protestant people, right? So it's not really a religious thing. That's the kind of way you have to look at those First Amendment arguments. Are they really drawing a religious, is it really based on religious belief, or are they just singling out one particular group?
You probably could say that they're religious based on their underlying religious principles, and that they don't believe in same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
I wonder if
But this is a whole area in the law which is unrelated to gay marriage, where the question of sincere religious belief against equality for gay people runs up against obligations the law tries to impose. And we're going to have the next 10 years trying to work out the distinction between those two, and it's going to all depend on context and exactly what kind of function that you're performing and how private or public it is. For example, in California Supreme Court, they just recently held that you can't be a doctor and refuse to treat lesbian people, provide whatever it was, fertility treatments in the Benitez case. And basically, I think one of the lines you're going to start to see is there's a distinction between acting in your in a employment capacity or in a workplace as opposed to in a church or a home or in some private organization like the Boy Scouts or something like that. And so, I mean, there are things that the government can make you do in some situations that you may or may not believe in just on the basis of equality. Now, in terms of an adoption agency, I'm not sure how that comes out, but you'd have to look at it and see, are they really performing a public function, or is this a religious function? And, you know, are they basically being delegated to this by the state as instead of the state doing it? And in that situation, do you want to have them say, I mean, what if you had an organization that was white supremacist that was doing that? Would you let them do that? I don't think so, you know. So, my sense is that probably ends up coming out against the Catholic Church, but... Those are the kinds of harsh, hard, real difficult line drawing questions that are starting to come up all the time now. Yeah.
I know this is a little outside the scope of your talk, but...
Forget it then. No.
You predicted that a lot of the legal issues regarding gay marriage will be resolved in the next 10, 20, however many years. Is there another legal frontier for the gay movement that you can foresee? Could you foresee affirmative action coming up, or something like that?
You know, I think that actually once an equality agenda has been won in this area, the affirmative action issue does not follow like the night to day in this situation, because gay people come from all walks of life, all income strata. There is no sort of, while they're a discrete insular minority in one sense, clearly a history of oppression and really all those sort of things, there are good arguments for heightened scrutiny. They're not economically, it's not a subclass, you know, it's not an underclass. And so I think once the barriers are eliminated to gay people being in all walks of life and in all activities and things like that, the argument for affirmative action would be extraordinarily weak. And I don't think, you never hear anybody talk about that. It seems to me this is an area where the legal issues can be resolved in fairly short order and then we can all move on.
Do you think that the marriage issue is going to be sort of the watershed for equality?
Well, I think that combined with, I hope, will be an enormous amount of a legislative progress in the next 8 years. I think it'll make a tremendous difference if Congress now becomes an engine for equality. It hasn't been done anything since before Lawrence, or it hasn't done anything. But they keep promising us. But Barack Obama promised 2 days ago, again on his website, that they're going to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell legislatively. So I think that would be an enormous, in many ways more important than employment non-discrimination, would be integrating the military. Because that requires some real courage and standing up to people who really feel quite emotionally against that, about something which involves the safety of the country and all that sort of thing. So that's a big deal. But I think there's every reason to think that they'll do it. I'm really hopeful that the president-elect means what he says in this area. Yeah.
I'm President-elect Barack Obama. He mentioned gay and straight people in his address at Grant Park, and I just wanted to, that's what you think the likelihood of is repealing the federal bill on gay may not fit into a 4 or not complete year plan.
Oh, I think he will try to do that. At least the part that prevents the federal government from recognizing actual married people, which is in many ways the most odious aspect of DOMA that people don't focus on. You know, you can be married. People in Massachusetts right now are married, don't get federal rights at all. And so that's Section 3 of DOMA. Whether they will end up repealing the Section 2, which is, he said he's in favor of repealing, that's the one that says other states don't have to recognize Massachusetts marriages. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what they do about that in the next few years. But I would be surprised if there isn't a movement, if there's 8 years of Democratic rule in President Obama, toward at least having the federal government recognize actual married people, because what's the federal interest in not recognize that? You know, the federal government has never in our history played a role in defining rights of domestic relations. You know, who can get married, who can get divorced, on what terms. That's always been a state function. And suddenly they pass this law that says, even though you're actually married, we're going to pretend you're not. And therefore you don't get survivor's benefits and you don't get to file your tax return jointly. And what is the federal interest in doing any of that? I just don't understand it. So if it's not repealed, it'll be challenged. I think that's a case that could also be won in the Supreme Court, I think. But that's sort of where I see that go.
I have a quick question. Recently I heard Mike Huckabee kind of oddly say the phrase words matter when he was talking about this issue. And I hear you saying similar thing, that the word marriage matters.
Right.
And it seems like that has something to do with the fact that the word marriage in our culture plays on a lot of different, largely religious themes, a lot of those types of associations. And my question is, what business does the government have using the word marriage as a category at all.
No, it's been doing it for about 600 years or something.
Is that another way to reconcile California?
Well, there is a whole group of people out here that say that the state should stop using the marriage word, and this will solve all the problems, and we'll just have everybody will get civil unioned, and then we'll let the churches decide who gets to use the M word. And that, you know, that's a nice elegant solution, but it seems to me there's sort of two problems with it. One, the state has been using the M word for 600 years, and so there's no real reason why you have to do that. I mean, it's been a civil institution as well as a religious institution, and if only you integrate one, and it doesn't mean you're integrating the other. And I think people ought to be able to figure out that there are two different uses, and they're only focusing on one. But the other thing is, as a practical matter, can you imagine us going to the straight people of this world and saying, you've got to stop getting married by the state because we want everything to be equal. From now on, if you can't go down to the justice of the peace and get married anymore, you can only get civil unioned. And, you know, what are the chances of a state legislature doing that? I mean, it's just inconceivable, it seems to me. So it's a nice, elegant solution in theory, but it doesn't seem like as an agenda to try to accomplish. If you're trying to work toward equality, it makes a great deal of sense because it just doesn't seem practical to me. I mean, I may be missing that, but I mean, do you think there's any chance that could pass?
I'm not sure it could pass, but I think that highlights the fact that to a certain extent, the use of the term marriage, we are at least playing in part on classifications that are properly religious, and that if the state sanctioning that, it seems like that's really the problem. It's not the problem isn't that the Catholic Church says marriage is a sacrament and it can only be shared by certain people in certain situations. It seems like the fact, if you start using the term marriage, if you want to take that kind of sanctity that the Catholic Church attaches to marriage, and then say that same, I think we're blurring the line between the state use of marriage and the religious use of marriage by saying that the use of the word marriage is important. If we're admitting that the term itself is important, I think it's because we're playing on some of that.
I don't really agree with that. I think the term is important because it's been the main civil institution by which we recognize couples in this country since before there was a country. And there's been judges marrying people in non-religious ways for the entire history of this country. And for us to suddenly say you can't have access to that because it's too religious an institution is really just not right. So I think I understand how it affects people emotionally because there is a sort of marriages happen in church concept. But then I think ultimately it is just not true. There are two parallel institutions with the roots back in ancient history before there was anybody come over from Europe to North America. I mean, it's a long time ago that civil institutions started developing around this and divorce laws and things like that. And so, I mean, my personal view is because of the practical problem and because there really are two different institutions that exist in parallel, we ought to be able to integrate one without offending anybody religiously. It's just people ought to be able to draw that distinction. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure it's any less difficult for the country to accept it if they're being forced to accept people who are married in Massachusetts and in Mississippi by virtue of the full faith and credit clause than that they're being forced to marry people in Mississippi. I mean, it's sort of the same thing in some ways. The merits of that argument are somewhat problematic. I've never really studied it closely, but I gather that the history has allowed states to draw some lines against a recognition of other states' marriages in certain circumstances based on public policy involving, in some cases, interracial marriage in the old days, some cases, first cousins and that sort of thing. Since a marriage is not a judgment, it's not at the core of what the Full Faith and Credit Clause is about. The Full Faith and Credit Clause is primarily about respecting other people's court judgments. And while it has some legal status as a decision by the state to recognize marriage, it's not really a judgment in the same sense. So where that goes, I don't know. And then there's DOMA on top of it, Congress purports to sort of weigh in against the application of that. So I don't know where that goes. But it's not clear to me that that's necessarily going to make it easier, more palatable for the country to accept marriage, although at least it would be slower, because there's only a certain number of people in any given state would be married if they had to go somewhere else and come back, maybe. I don't know. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about
Well, partly because that's the only place people have been making the argument. I mean, nobody's been asking federal courts to do it. And that's because there's been a sort of general sense that we don't necessarily think this is a good Supreme Court case right now. Also, state courts, because there are 50 different states and 50 different sort of sets of perspectives, you can go to places where more progressive people happen to be in the court. So sort of a natural strategy, once the federal courts became more conservative over the last 12 years, to look to the state courts. And this was not the first issue in which you saw this. In the sodomy laws, the state Supreme Courts for years and years were throwing these things out one by one in the state Supreme Courts. And then ultimately, with Lawrence, we were able to go back to the court and say, look, most states have gotten rid of this thing, these kinds of laws. And so it's a fairly traditional thing to go to the states and try to pick out the ones which will be most sympathetic. And that's what we've done. Sir.
That you think a challenge could come in too soon in terms of going to the Supreme Court. How real do you think that, you know, the possibility of that is, and where would you see it coming from? And if that did happen, what do you see that opinion looking like in terms of how you distinguish Lawrence?
Well, it could come from anywhere, you know. I mean, anywhere but Massachusetts or Connecticut, I guess, is where it could come from. Probably the most likely is California, because there's an awful lot of people out there who are very involved in this thing emotionally, and there's an awful lot of people out there. Now, how that case would come out, I don't know. It might be conceivable we could win. You'd have to ask Justice Kennedy, you know. I mean, who wrote Lawrence and wrote Romer. He's not an anti-gay person, and wrote some very elegant phrases about how gay relationships deserve equal respect. While simultaneously making it clear they weren't deciding the marriage issue. And so I don't know how that would be written. It's not easy to distinguish, but, you know, the nice thing about being in the U.S. Supreme Court is you can just say something and it's the law, you know. So it doesn't have to be all that logical sometimes. But, you know, I guess it's hard to predict how that will ultimately look. And, you know, I'm not even sure the other four more progressive justices would be ready to do that right now. It's a pretty new concept for them, so we'll see. Yes?
If in, say, 10 or 15 years, the Supreme Court does recognize gay marriage, what do you think the next forefronts in litigation involving marriage might be, or in redefining the federal and state benefits of marriage? Do you think we'll see changes to marriage, or will it be something that goes, okay, everyone goes up their hands and says, okay, new state, nothing changed, as after
Loving v.
Virginia.
I think it probably is more like the second. I don't see this turning into a sort of a new sea change and sort of a next. You thinking about a different kind of arrangement or something becoming, three people or something like that?
Discussion about how much marriage should get certain privileges from the government.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, it seems to me more likely that you'll end up with a movement of unmarried people wanting full equality, because what you're seeing in this country is an awful lot of people just not getting married, and the rates of illegitimacy, so-called, in this country, a term which will become, I think, non-PC fairly soon, just because it's so many people, is huge. And so, I mean, I think that ultimately, we may end up sort of seeing the institution become attacked by those who just simply don't think they should have to go through that formality and still get the same rights. It won't have anything to do with gay people. It'll be a bunch of straight people who claiming the rights to be treated with equality in terms of legal rights without having gone through the motions of getting married. So that seems more likely than polygamy or something becoming the issue. Yeah, Jason.
So Professor Goodwin Liu and General Rosenberg here have written somewhat about what happens when courts sort of lead public sentiment, and have been highly critical of the outcomes for the court's legitimacy in other areas of the law, and how people perceive their legitimacy when things like that happen. And as scholarship along those lines sort of continues to develop, how do you think that will affect the court's willingness to take up these issues and sort of continue to sort of lead the way on this issue, as you sort of suggested?
Well, it seems to me that courts have to be careful about those sorts of things in terms of maintaining their sense of legitimacy. On the other hand, there are times when courts want to spend some of that and get out in front of the population. And certainly Brown was a good example of that. I don't think anybody thinks it was a mistake to decide Brown versus Board of Education at the time it was decided, but they got way ahead of the population. In this area, what I think you're going to see, though, is you're going to end up seeing an awful lot of activity going on at the state level, including legislative activity. And one of the things that's happened in a lot of states is even a court decision gets followed by legislative activity. So in Massachusetts, the legislature ultimately refused to even put an amendment on the ballot. And so that gave it some democratic legitimacy. If we'd won in California, that would have been an enormous amount of democratic legitimacy given to the thing. So that was an enormous opportunity lost in some ways. But I think this is not an area where the backlash problem will be too severe, in part because I think the groundwork's getting laid gradually over time. Maybe I'm not saying it'll be as easy as Lawrence turned out to be in terms of backlash, but if it happens in due time, I think the country will have come around to that position. At least that would be my hope. Yeah. How are we doing on time? Got a few minutes?
Yeah.
One more question?
Yeah.
I just wanted to press you actually on that same point, because after the 2004 election, there was a lot of talk that all of these amendments that passed in the states banning marriage were sort of a result of the Massachusetts decision.
Right.
Do you think that they can't pass any more amendments in the states about marriage because
they're already there,
all
yeah.
decided, but I think it was Arkansas just passed a horrible amendment about adoption.
Right.
Is that a possibility in other states?
Well, I think this adoption thing is continuing to become the next battlefront, I think, although I think it's a front on which the gay side wins more easily because people are used to the idea that everybody should be able to adopt, as individuals at least. In terms of backlash, I think there are various sides in the debate about the extent to which John Kerry's loss can be blamed on gay people and gay rights. There may have been some amount of impact on that. But if so, it was a very short term. I mean, they tried to figure out ways to use the gay rights issue in 2006 and 2008, and it just didn't have any saliency at all. I mean, people are just way over this. Suddenly we have real problems in this country. And so I think this was, at least I hope, and it does seem like the sort of usefulness of using gay people as a whipping boy on this kind of political issue was very short term. Maybe it'll change back again as the Democrats are in power and you start to see legislative developments in more marriage. Maybe it'll change back, but hopefully not. I mean, it certainly got a lot of people to the polls in 2004. There's no doubt about that, all those amendments on the ballot. Well, thank you, everybody.